Okay, hello, Benita. Welcome. She's going to inaugurate our Tools for Conviviality series, which we're doing at Parallax. Tools for Conviviality is a phrase that comes from Ivan Illich, and he's our prompt. He's our prompt for this series. We're going to look at some of his work. We're going to look at other people's works, but our theme is based on the idea of, let's say, technologies of conviviality. You know, and how do we work in this hyper-tech world, and how do we retain our humanity? How do we retain a convivial relationship with each other? So Benita is going to begin her month-long course on September 3rd. And the title of the course is, what was the title again,
Benita? The Convivial Life.
The Convivial Life. And so she's going to introduce herself and introduce the course module, and we'll just jump right into that.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, we're both really big fans of Ivan Illich. And when you read him, you realize he lived in a time that we don't have very much of that anymore. You know, like he talked a lot about having friends over in the university and eating and drinking. You know, he says symposium literally means, you know, with wine, and he thought of education and learning and religion as friends around a table, you know, like this is not an experience that we have opportunity to have very much anymore. So I'm hoping that the course will prompt us to engage with each other like we're friends around the table. And I know you have this like campfire session at the end of the day that I think can really lend itself to that. So having said that, I just, you know, I'm going to go through this like geeky presentation. It's going to first give a short summary, then it's going to expand that summary, and then it's going to expand the summary the third time. And it's kind of geeky, but I want you to remember that what we're hoping to achieve in the course is this sense of conviviality, this sense of friendship that Ivan Illich often talked about. So I just want to put that out there at the beginning. So the title of my course is The Convivial Life. It takes a larger kind of view of this notion of conviviality. And the subtitle is Conversations Between Ivan Illich and Friends. And this is because we're going to use Ivan Illich as prompts because he's very provocative and he says things that kind of switch perspectives and shifts our idea of things. And then we're going to bring in other voices that are more contemporary to see, well, where are we at? And how does Jan Zawicki talk about this? Or Timothy Morton talk about this? You know, what are these other voices that have come into the conversation since Ivan Illich? So we're going to kind of call these conversations into reality. Okay, so the course has four modules. And the first module is on education. The second modules will be the heart of what you're talking about, tools, technology, and techne. The third module will be on institutions and the production of subjectivity. And the last module will be on church and state. And, you know, you can recognize that Ivan Illich had a lot to say about all of these topics, but during the course, we'll notice that what he has to say about institutions is reflected in what he has to say about education. What he has to say about tools, technology is reflected back in all of these categories. You know, everything in his work, he has a certain thematic presence so that these look like bullets but they're not independent of each other. So we'll be able to get this sense that one thing leads and reflects back to the other. So in education, we're going to talk about something I call consumer education and invite his words into what he thinks education is about. We're going to contrast that with village education. And then we're going to look at this proposition of saying without naming. So here we're inviting the Tao Te Ching and Christopher Alexander into the conversation around education. So this is part of inviting friends into the conversation. In the second module, Tools, Technology, and Techne, will be talking about Ilyich's notion of tools for conviviality, proportion, and human scale. And then we're going to move it into something very contemporary conversation around the AI apocalypse and see if we can find in Ilyich some prescience or warning or even possibility and opportunity. And then we're going to invite Timothy Morton in to have a conversation with us through his book, All Art is Ecological. So we'll talk about art and aesthetic reason. The next module is Institutions and the Production of Subjectivity. This is the third module. We're going to look at Ilyich's notion of people versus systems. We're going to look at the death of the communal self and the production of conviviality. So we'll talk, we'll unpack these a little more in the next series of slides. And finally, the last module will be around this tension between church and state. We're going to cover politics and governance, the religious life, and the Good Samaritan, which was a huge guiding and anchoring story or parable all the way through Ivan Ilyich's life. So we'll be inviting actually E.E. Cummings in to talk with Ilyich about the Good Samaritan. So this is kind of the way the modules are set up, the four weekly modules. Does that make sense? You're muted.
Yes, that makes sense. That sounds great. I guess as you were talking, a few things jumped out, and one was, you know, the difference between consumer education and village education. That stuck out to me. And I'd be very interested in hearing your points of view about that. I know Ivan Ilyich wrote a book called Deschooling Society.
Yeah.
So we can also talk about the difference between education and school.
Yeah.
And I also love the image of the table, sitting around the table. We just got back from Vermont and we had a big conversation around a table, let's say.
The table was big.
A very big table where we talked about Zack Snyder and Mark Gaffney's work, and it was quite lively. So anyway, yeah. So what is the difference, let's say, between consumer education and a village education? How do you conceive of that?
Yeah, I mean, we could go through the next series of slides. I don't want to give away too much.
Right.
The education module is really big. We're going to invite Jan Zielwicki in with her reflections. I have a lot of PDFs for people, so they don't have to go out and buy or search for articles. But it's interesting that you mentioned the conversation on cosmoerotic humanism, because this notion here of the religious life and the Good Samaritan can interestingly weave into some of the work that Gaffney and Stein are doing. And maybe that would be a really nice fireside chat too, to compare and contrast the voices in this module with the contemporary scene, not only with Gaffney and Stein, but you know, we have the people around John Vervaeke, mm-hmm. who, like Chris Master Priocho and Jonathan Peugeot, who are interested, you know, young people interested in reformulating a religious attitude So this is a very, you know, this is like the kind of conversations we want to have, is like to take this material and then say what's happening in our community that we can see now. And education obviously is a big one, including reflecting back on what is Parallax Academy? Like, what is education, you know? So just bringing this into a real experience, I think, would be great around the fireside chats, you know?
Yeah, and also, I remember Marsha McLuhan saying that since television was invented, education takes place outside of the classroom.
Yeah.
So maybe there's an interesting discussion about inside and outside. And, you know, I guess Parallax is an outside, you know, not a school. It's an outside liminal hub of people who are interested in ideas and are doing education in a certain way, and then doing something else in another way. And what that is it's very liminal at this point, right?
Exactly. And of course, Ilyich wasn't against education. He was against the state and institutionalization of education, because he believed it didn't serve to teach children. And we are going to bring in Jacques Rancière. Is that how he says his name? I know you're French, so I feel bad about Rancière, The Ignorant Schoolmaster. Do you know this book?
No, I don't. No.
Okay, so this is a very fun book. I do have a PDF of it for people who want to snatch that up. It's a beautiful fiction, nonfiction, and it's really, really cool. We're going to bring him in, Five Lessons in Intellectual Emancipation. I was actually turned on by this book by Peter Lindbergh. So that, you know, just getting this sense of these voices we're going to bring in around these topics. And when we get to this one, this is the third, and this is the third module, and I'll unpack that in the next slides, but we'll look at Ivan Ilyich's notion of systems and the age of systems, where he says there are no more tools, there's only systems. But the death of the communal self and the production of conviviality, these are, we're going to workshop this module. I have actual games people can play and figure out what their trust networks are and how they use their time and whether they're moving toward or away from the convivial society. So this third module will be real hands-on and real workshop-y. So that's something people can look forward to.
Well, maybe I should have asked you this in the beginning, but I know that you you have something called the pop-up school, and you do educational things online, but also that you're a very hands-on person, that you work with horses and that you work with, you know, farming and things that are very, very practical. So I don't know, maybe you want to talk a little bit about the way you work with people and the way you teach and the way you explore these ideas.
Yeah, so let me stop sharing my screen. We'll come back and do the rest of the slide afterwards. Well, one thing people will notice is that I tell a lot of stories and give a lot of examples, but they're always stories from the natural world. So it's kind of, people might, they're not always, but people might get the impression that I don't live in the human world. We're gonna, interestingly enough, the last module, when we talk about the religious life, and we'll, you know, I'll have to come back to the slide, but the slides that we didn't show, what we're gonna pick up on of the many things that Ilyich talked about, he has this statement. He says that Jesus was not God coming back as man, he's God coming back as flesh. And he talks about religious as enfleshment. And he complains about the progressive, he uses this word, disenfleshment of each generation. And what I teach at the, it's very resonant with what I teach at the pop-up school, which is not abstract. Like, these things are not abstractions. They are meant, you know, he talks about the deep carnality of God, the deep carnality of Jesus, that love and loving, these are not abstractions. And this is what he complains about. The church becomes institutionalized and corporatized, and then the Christian nation state becomes, evolves from that that design. And people are robbed of the moral encounter with the other, that you know, you just give money and they have corporations and institutions that take care of things. And he wants to reclaim the carnality of the religious life. And so, you know, so by the time we finish, we're going to be talking about a lot of the kinds of work I do, which is to reflect these ideas, embed them in our actual life. So the workshop we do, which I just did in upstate New York for an organization called Endemic, and they're working on sacred societies. You'll actually see that you have certain trust styles, and the convivial society, the core of a convivial society is trust. And then there's these domains of care, and we'll actually workshop that into insights. So we're gonna get there. When we get to the enfleshment, God as carnality, that's a real—
That's great. That's
a bonding thing, you know?
God as carnality, it's even more than, you know, people keep talking about embodiment, but that almost goes another layer. Enfleshment.
No, exactly.
Embodiment. It goes even deeper than embodiment.
He's serious. I mean, the thing about him, he uses words like this because he's serious, you know? He's like, yeah, God became man. But he already knows that people, it doesn't hit them enough. It doesn't, you know, for him, when he understands these parables in religious life, he takes it seriously. And so this is why he uses these words like, you know, carnality and enfleshment. And we'll end up talking about the Good Samaritan, and we'll see why he says everybody knows the story of the Good Samaritan, nobody gets it. And it's this—
yeah, this it's not mere altruism or something like that. It's much, much— again, he brings a deeper level to that. He talks about the institutionalization of sin, where altruism has become even altruism has become an abstraction.
Exactly.
It has become institutionalized, and so again, he really wants to bring things back to the table, to the body, to all these things that are
exactly
that make us, you know, human animals. Yeah. and
you know,
spiritual.
we're not going to talk about it, but he got into trouble because he even tried to talk about gender. And a lot of the women in the women's movement and the feminists in the Catholic Church were big fans of him, and he wrote this book, and people just didn't get it. They thought it was like a pre-trans fallacy. He wasn't saying women should go back to patriarchal societies, but he was saying there's something serious about the body and the difference in the body because of this emphasis he has on carnality. And so the women would hear the carnality in the body, and then they get really confused why he sounded like he was back in this dark ages, you know, advocating for like gender differences or something. So
yeah. And actually, I think his meaning of gender is something different than how it's conceived of today.
Exactly.
He was talking about complementarity, and he distinguished that from what he called economic sex, you know, sex roles, you know.
Yes.
And so he was talking about the complementarity of male and female, femaleness.
Yeah.
I think I heard actually David Cayley say that he took this term, was actually he kind of brought that term into being, and then people ran away with it and made it something else.
Yeah.
So the book almost doesn't make sense to us today because of how we think of what gender is.
And you know, the great irony here is that he had a theory of inversion, right? that something good, when overscaled, let's say by modernity, becomes the worst of the worst. So yes, the church does the worst atrocities, but it started as something good. And his work was also inverted. You know, the meaning of his work also kept them being inverted because people just didn't understand him because he's much more complex. He's a much more complex thinker than you might imagine at first.
I think that in the first part of his life, he was more revolutionary and he kind of attracted the revolutionary types. And then he dropped out of the game because he realized that they were co-opting his ideas, and he realized that he couldn't argue against them. Like, there was no argument possible against that kind of virile ideology. So he just left the game for a long time. But some of his later work is very deep and interesting, and I think less people know about it.
Yeah.
And I think that that's also, you know, when he spoke about the Samaritan, it's also a good thing to bring him back into this discourse and bring back the more forgotten aspects of his thinking, which are less, you know, they're less revolutionary in flavor and they're more deeper and even theological in the sense that you were talking about before.
Yeah, and you know, he didn't fit anywhere, right? So he taught in Latin America because the pastoral experience there was very community life and very close to the community. And then the church got very active in the politics of Latin America. And he's like, I'm out of here, right? Because this whole politicalization or professionalization or institutionalization of the religious impulse, he was really strongly wary of that. So again, so he builds up this fan base in Latin America, and then people get confused, like, why not? Like, the Catholic Church is taking hold of Latin America because of this revolutionary spirit. And he's like, no, I'm out of here. And this kind of thing happened to him a lot. Mm-hmm. Like,
he was canceled by both the radicals and by the Catholic Church.
Yes.
They brought him in and they basically did an inquisition on him, nearly, like, if you read the biography of him.
So, yeah, he was always canceled by his own fan base.
Uh-huh, yeah.
So he's a hero of our time.
Exactly. I love the canceled people. Even at Parallax, and the people we've been talking to are often people who are just not, they don't fit anywhere. They don't fit in academic life, and they don't fit in other places. And I think that's the Parallax. That's the Parallax realm, if I could say so, that we aspire to.
It's kind of like having a nose for, if anything gains popularity quickly, you have, in this climate, you have to be suspicious about it, right? It's like, well, it's so popular. What's the hook, or what if we don't know that other people know or something? And I think Parallax is a lot like that. Like Alexander Vardy would be saying something, and you can hear someone saying, oh, he's a good blah, blah, blah. But then he's like, no, but like most people, they start to say something or frame something and you can see where that sentence ends. And most of the people at Parallax, where they're going with it, you didn't see it before. You didn't see it coming, you know?
That's great. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's this real opportunity to have conversation that's not scripted, right? And that is provocative, and that is co-creative, so that everyone's surprised at the end of the day.
So, yeah, and I guess people kind of, I was talking to OJ Rose, this guy, a philosopher, I think you'd like him, he's a great guy. He was talking about how we're always thinking about what other people are thinking in this time, because we have so many voices in our head from the internet. So it's very hard to actually think of something or to come up with something novel or interesting, because it's very easy to fall into a script.
Yes.
And I guess with ChatGPT and everything that's coming, it's like everything's becoming scripted. Yeah. There has to be a counter movement against that. And I think Ivan Illich is the counter movement against that in many ways. The way he was, the way he behaved, the way he wrote, everything he did was provocative in the best possible sense.
Yeah. Well, because he was speaking from his true with his true intuitive self, right? So Gentlin says, when you are trying to articulate what is deeply most yours, you will not find public definitions for it, because public definitions are always generalizations, right? Mm-hmm. So I mean, this is a good point. I mean, one of the things we can do in the course is try to help people speak, you know, like a new language, like speak from what is operating in them right now that that they will be surprised when it comes out of their mouth, right? Like what did I say the other day? I want the words to come out of my mouth the way the dance comes out of my body, entirely free of my mind. And Illich was kind of like this. This is why David Cayley did so much for him, because he was the more systematic interlocutor for Illich. And when Illich just went off and wrote a book, people didn't really understand it, because you get the sense that the spirit was just coming out of his mouth in this way that he was kind of rabid to express, but there was not enough bridges for people to really understand him.
Yeah, I think that's true of kind of radical religious thinkers, because they're discovering things as they arise, and like almost like a revelation. So that later on people come and say, oh, this is a, then later on people come and try to understand it and could work with it. And the best of them, you know, continue to give new information. Like, you can't pin them down, you know, with any kind of system, but they, mm-hmm. but there's always a way to learn more. So I think, yeah, I think David kind of helped bring his later work into a frame which people could, you know, connect to the earlier stuff. Because he was, at one point he was like Jordan Peterson in the 1960s. He was huge. Yeah. He filled up, you know, at one point he was a huge intellectual hero. But that also says something about him that really appeals to me, like that he would quit the game, you know, when he was ahead in some kind of a way, instead of riding on that wave of popularity.
He was definitely not susceptible to audience capture. In fact, he might have been a little too quick to pivot. But you know, he, this is why he would say that when you codify religion, it becomes a text, and you know, and mimetically reproduced, it becomes a perversion, because then you have people who are just, they're not religious, they're students, they're intellectual students of the religion or something, versus you know, being very, very aware and receptive to what is arising in the other that is already sacred. You know, I was working with some young people, and we were trying to figure out how to write a magazine article around education and sacred societies. And we were going around and around. And then I said, you know, the connection is education's already a sacred act. It's like the whole key is to notice that this relationship with the child or the teacher, it's already a sacred relationship. And then everything falls from there, not to like try to figure out how to make education a sacred relationship. It's to notice that it's given in our human condition already, that it's a sacred relationship.
Yeah, and yeah, that's right. And that is the essence of his thinking, Ivan Illich, which was about mm-hmm. philia, which was about friend. He talked about friendship, that is the essence of the educational relationational relationship, not in some kind of a way that people meet each other and then, you know, relationships develop and then, you know, we learn together. When you try to institutionalize that, I know this because I'm a teacher, and I know that, you know, when you go in front of a classroom, you have relationships with a couple people, and most of the people are kind of like, they're sitting there like they're watching TV. So it's like, I think one of the opportunities of with a course like this and with the kind of stuff, this kind of stuff, is to move into that space of real, let's say, you know, the proper, let's say, learning relationship, which is not, which can't be sort of institutionalized or categorized or, you know, put into any sterile frame.
And like Ian McGilchrist said, you know, the institutions are, they have too many rules. So you can't have this kind of philia and this deep engagement if there are too many rules. I lecture, you listen, you know, because then I go and I play the game. Like as a student, I play the game, like, okay. Or, and I'm not allowed to show up as who I am in the context that my life is going right now, because I already implicitly know that that's not allowed in this game. We're gonna, in the education piece, we're gonna look at, I think his name is Jules Henry. Could be Henry Jules. I hate these people with two first names because I can never remember. We have Donald Oliver too. And but he talks about like what is actually being learned by the child is what the child actually learns is the extracurricular rules that society wants, not the content. Most of the cognitive work that the child is learning so he talks about little Johnny goes on the board and he's asked to work out a math problem and he doesn't know how to solve it. So what he's learning is about the violence, the inherent violence and disrespect in his culture, right? Because the teacher knows he can't do it. Everybody's like laughing at him. So he won't remember all his algebra, but he will remember that what something about society from that experience. And so that's always a question. We're going to talk about ontological design. We'll read Jan Zawicki talking about why she left, you know, really a good staggering pay job university. So all this is like, you know, there's so much to do here, but the course hasn't started yet.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I guess I'm just jumping into a conversation with you and not being very systematic here, but I think that's fine. I think maybe people will get the flavor, you know, of who you are and what you want to transmit, and then in terms of what we're doing, people will have lectures, but then we'll, I guess we're moving from the form is that we move from the lecture format to the towards the campfire kind of thing. So we move from a more formal to a more informal structure, and that people will get to know each other a little bit, and that, you know, we can build connections and communities and you know, within communities, and that will be what we're saying it is, you know, it's tools for conviviality.
Right. Yeah, that's an interesting, you know, even parallax in the and the digital environment, the design of your course, you know, these are all tools and you know, I know you put a lot of attention to like how can they be convivial? What is the size and scale? I love the campfire idea afterwards on the same day. So there's not like this huge amount of time, because a lot of times during classes, and I know my classes are 2 hours, and then right at the end you get this really big insight, and there's everyone's really high, and then you jump off of Zoom, you know, and 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 few of us have the luxury of them running downstairs and having a family that want to hear us like go on and on. Plus, it's not easy to translate what experience you've just had to people that weren't there, you know? So yeah, so I hope people really sign up for the campfire thing. I didn't understand it at first, and then when I finally got it, like, because I was really dense, I'm like, wow, that's a really cool idea.
Yeah. And it is, you know, we're sitting around the digital, you know, a digital screen, or we're sitting around this energy, right? That we're so we're seeing these faces flicker in the fire, in a sense. So it's an apt, I guess.
They do, you know, when people light up when they're learning things. It is like that.
Uh-huh.
So I'm wondering if you want to see the last like extended presentation, because maybe you can use it.
Yes, sure.
Yeah. The last version has some of these provocative statements that we're going to be working with. So
great.
Yeah.
And I can maybe I can edit this to so it makes sense. Or
yeah, you could put out the short version, and then you could, and, you know, you could use them separately. So let's
great. It. Okay, go for it.
Okay, where am I? So we're going to go down to here, I think. I'm going to get rid of that. I hate this loading. I'm going to go down to here. Okay. So now we're going to look at, the four modules, and we are going to unpack the, each module has three areas. And now we're going to look at the unpack the three areas a little more, just to give people a little more depth into how the what the course outline is. This will also, you know, be the outline that they can see on the website. Okay, so we start with consumer education, and we'll find out that the real purpose of education is elevate the consumer standards of each generation. This is a claim that Illich made, and we'll look at some recent research by an economist, Brian Kaplan, who tries to figure out why education is so expensive and comes to similar conclusions. So consumer education will become the human capital theory of the next decade as the global society transitions from economies based on labor and income to economies based on consumption and debt. So this will be carrying his idea forward. We're gonna look at some economies, and I have a couple of brief medium articles we can read on that. Then we'll talk about village education, and we'll talk about the ontological design of education is the extracurricular signal that will outlast the curricular content, right? So people have often said that when the Industrial Revolution happened, one of the things kids had to learn was to be on time, to sit in rows, to stay still for a long period of time. And this is the extracurricular content. And we'll work with Jan Zawicki, talk about like, what is it like to, you know, she teaches philosophy of environmental science. And, you know, she's always talking about nature and this and that, and yet she sits in this horrible classroom. So there's this tension between the message and the environment, right? Typical day in class, if it's a village education, would have the same sensory motor stimulation of a typical day sauntering through a village, participating in the vibrant life of well-placed community, grounding the children in both a sense of belonging and place. So if you're trying to get a convivial society and a sense of community and friendship, and children are spending 90% of their time, their waking life, in schools, which are not convivial and not like village-like, then you're working at odds to each other. The forces that you are training into the child are at odds with each other. So if we want to make villages, we have to have education that's like a village. And then we'll look at this thing. It's an article that I wrote, Saying Without Naming, which argues that educare means to bring forth more life. It's based on something, the work of Christopher Alexander. And it just says, we know that by saying we will capture just some, but not all, and perhaps not much of what is possible to say. To say but not name means to keep open the past over possibilities through an artful use of language. So how can we design language so that what the teacher is not reifying and naming what is, but that it's much more dialogical and lively. So this is not something that is self-explanatory, but just kind of a preview of some of the cool stuff that we're gonna get to in the education. And as I said before, we're gonna invite Jacques Rancière into the conversation with this little text, The Ignorant Schoolmaster. It's very provocative. So that's the first module. We get to tools, technology, and technique. So we start with tools for conviviality. Ivan Ilyich said, why shouldn't it be possible to think about objects of daily use as products of human intention and the use of appropriate tools? So the word appropriate here is very important. And so we'll think about how he thought about tools. And then he said, it should be clear by this point that I think that modern technological society stands in the same relation to this discovery of tools as the death of nature does to the discovery of nature as a continuous and contingent creation. So on the one hand, he advocates for convivial tools, but then he says that modern technological society has a relationship to tools that has resulted in the death of nature. So this is very, you know, this is one of the things he says. He's extremely provocative, because if you think he's making a case for tools, why would he make such a case against technology? So this is him being a provocative. And then we're going to look at some contemporary conversations and debates and arguments and claims around the AI apocalypse. We'll already have heard how Ilyich problematizes what is the inversion of useful tools to worrisome technologies. He said digital technology lacks instrumentality. It lacks the necessary distance between a tool and the user. He predicted the digital age and the end of the tool era. So he's again very provocative. He said the hammer remains an instrument of the person, not the system. In a system, the user, the manager, logically, by the logic of the system, becomes part of the system. Therefore, I would strongly stress that within our lifetime, we have left the epoch during which the instrument dominated self-awareness, world awareness, and philosophical explanation of the world in language. And this is when he gets into talking about how we no longer have tools, we have systems that have us. So we'll look at that in another module. But then we're going to reclaim some positive spirit here. We're going to look at art and aesthetic reason as an alternative to tools, technology, and techne. Well, this is the techne part. We're going to read a short little book if people have time, but we'll talk about it by Timothy Morton called All Art is Ecological. I'll make it available in PDF form. And this is what Timothy Morton says in his book. We'll be seeing how the experience of art provides a model for the kind of coexistence of ecological ethics and politics wants to achieve between humans and non-humans. Why is that? That's because beauty gives you a fantastic, impossible access to the inaccessible, to the withdrawn, open qualities of things, their mysterious reality. So we can see Timothy Morton as a contemporary interlocutor with Ivan Ilyich in this thing. And so Timothy Morton, All Art is Ecological, will be part of the conversation. In the third module, we're going to talk about institutions and the production of subjectivity. This is the workshop. We're going to do a lot of workshopping here where you're going to actually fill out your own trust network and your trust styles and the domains of care through your own experience. And we can share and contrast that. So this is where we get into people versus systems. So here's something provocative that Illich said. The Gaia hypothesis takes on a gruesome meaning when it is used by someone who has been swallowed by the system to express his self-consciousness. So here's again, you might think, Ivan Illich, he must love the Gaia hypothesis. But no, yet again, you know, he has all these kinds of ways of exiting that he surprises you, right? There's always these surprises. So this is something, this is the quote we'll use to be provocative, to ask these questions. So he writes, what the person who has himself been swallowed by the world conceived as a system, a world represented or made present to his fantasy in a disconnected but seductive sequence of visiotypes. So Bruno Latour has said this also in his Gifford lectures. He said, like, if you call it a vegetable, a giant machine, or Gaia, it's the same violence because you're reducing the world to an object that you can manipulate in language. So that's what we'll be talking about here. Death of the communal self. At the core of the convivial society is the communal self generating networks of trust. Each one of us has a distinct trust styles that shift according to context, and we'll be figuring out, finding out our trust styles by this workshop. We'll look at the production of conviviality. So communities produce subjectivity by ontological design and all this. So how can we produce a convivial subject? The convivial society is constituted by the four domains of care. We'll workshop this, but we have the commons, which is non-reciprocal care plus shared spaces or places. An economy in the kind of Wendell Berry sense of the world is reciprocal care plus a ledger, some kind of accounting system. A platform is disintermediated care plus a network. And a congregation is deep mutuality and shared assembly. So these are this whole module will be workshopping these ideas in a hands-on sort of way. And we'll be looking at an expansion of Donald Oliver's model that our society has three overlapping spheres, the primal, the vital, and the modern. And we'll look at expanding that into the hypothetical metamodern. So people, I think, will really grok that. And I'll talk more about these in the pre-recorded videos. And so then once we get to the live sessions, we can go through it and just have peer-to-peer conversations around it. And finally, the last module, church and state. We have politics and governance. So here's a provocative statement by Ivan Illich. Whenever I look for the roots of modernity, I find them in the attempts of the churches to institutionalize, legitimize, and manage Christian vocation. So he saw the emergence of Christian Europe as coming from the design, the political and governance design of the church, which of course came from Neoplatonism. So he wrote, Christian Europe is unmanageable with its deep concern about building institutions that take care of different types of people in need. So there is no question that modern service society is an attempt to establish and extend Christian hospitality. On the other hand, we have immediately perverted it. The personal freedom to choose who will be my other has been transformed into the use of power and money to provide a service. This not only deprives the idea of the neighbor of the quality of freedom implied in the story of the Samaritan, it also creates an impersonal view of how a good society ought to work. It creates needs, so-called, for service commodities, needs which can never be satisfied. Is there enough health yet, enough education? And therefore a type of suffering completely unknown outside of Western culture with its roots in Christianity. So this is a very severe critique of not only the world he lived in, but a big warning, like, what are we doing in this time between worlds? Are we satisfying needs that actually are iatrogenetic and they actually cause a new kind of suffering that the world has never seen before? So like there's a, you know, he's got an intense mind and an amazing gift for perspectival shifts. So this is again, these are prompts that we will be working with for having conversations. Then the religious life. Here's another cool perspectival shift. And this is where we can talk about some of these religious movements, cross movements in our community. How is it that Jewish people came into existence around their prophets? It says prophets, but it means prophets. So he says, what makes the ancient Jews unique is that they became a social we, an I in the plural, around the message that whatever happens in history or could be seen in nature is a foreshadowing in the sense that pregnancy foreshadows birth. And I thought this was very provocative because it kind of pings on something Jordan Hall said in Vermont, and that is that to become a we, it has to do something with religion. And this is the question that you see Ilyich being fascinated with. The prophets of Israel made the astonishing claim that they could step outside the family, so get outside of that that structure, and step out of the tribal context in which tomorrow turns in a circle with yesterday. So students of Gebser will notice that prior to the modern age, the cycle of family and tribal was cyclical. And these prophets, and I would argue the Neoplatonists, they had this claim that they could speak about a tomorrow, that they could be visionaries outside of these cycles, which would be totally surprising. And this is what we know as messianic. And so it's a kind of definition of the religious life. And finally, the Good Samaritan. God didn't become man, he became flesh. And we were talking about this, and this is real juicy stuff that we end with. I believe in a God who is enfleshed and who has given the Samaritan as a being drowned in carnality, the possibility of creating a relationship by which an unknown chance encounter becomes for him the reason for his existence as he becomes the reason for the other's survival, not just in a physical sense, but a deeper sense as a human being. God's love is in the flesh, and the relationship between two people, the mystery of the Samaritan, is inevitably a mystery of the flesh. This becomes very difficult to explain or even to say in our generation, during which I believe an extraordinary process and an extraordinary history of disenfleshment of our perceptions, concepts, and our senses has reached a high point. So, those are mouthfuls, but I think you get the sense of what we're attempting to do here and the energy and the liveliness around his provocations.
Yeah, that's so great. For me, it's like, I think you just sort of outlined the questions that have been with me for so long after reading Ilyich, right? You can't be unmoved by reading Ilyich. Seems to me, if you really read them, and the questions resonate and remain, and kind of you can spend your whole life working with them. Yes. And I think you laid out those questions a little bit well. So this is, when I asked you to do this, this goes beyond my expectations. I think it's going to be wonderful. I hope people will come and
do this. There's so much provocative in him, but. You know, I have a lot of Ilyich's books. I have the big one by Kaylee, but it was your recommendation. I hadn't read this one. And most of the words I used were from here. So it was really nice to instead of me rereading what I'd read before, to read something new in a form that I hadn't read before. So it was a great recommendation, and I got a lot of quotes that what we're going to use for provocations from this little book.
And that's, I mean, I guess that's recommended for the whole series, that book, and maybe some of the podcasts that David did with Ilyich, so you can hear his voice, you can hear this book coming into being. You can find on David Cayley's podcast.
But you know, you're right, the kinds of questions that he lived with, that he transmits, he's actually transmitting the situation of being in question. And I think that he would say is the religious life, to be in those kinds of questions.
Yeah. And they're very big koans, you know, in a sense. They're big, you know, it's like the opposite of dogma.
The opposite of dogma. So yeah, great idea for a course, and I'm very excited about putting it together. And
okay, well, I hope everybody, I hope some people will sign up for this, and I'm sure it will be a rich exploration, a deepening of our understanding, you know, of, you know, the current moment. And then he kind of considered himself a man of the 12th century, and he wanted to bring the 12th century to the 21st century. And in other words, looking back into our deeper roots as human beings in order to understand this moment.
Yeah.
Seems, you know, to be what he's about as well.
And I just want to say, people are going to watch the recording this far, you don't have to know anything about Ilyich, you know, like, we're not here to study Ilyich. We're here to raise these questions in the context that we live today. So we will talk about AI. We will talk about these movements in the adjacent communities on the web that are asking these questions, and use his provocations to give it energy and seriousness.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Because there's a, it's more of, these are more universal human questions than anything to do with, it's not an academic study. It's something different than that, that we're trying to model, that we're trying to emulate and do here. So I think it's going to be great.
Awesome.